One of our ministers in the U.S., actually living on the West Coast, writes, "Pornography is a problem that is pandemic in our society, and it infiltrates the church. Over the past 5 years, I have dealt with it more times than I could have imagined 10 years ago." He writes this in relation to the many marriage counselings he has been involved in where pornography is a factor in the breakdown of marriage. One would not normally think so. You know, there is no shortage of information on the addictive nature of pornography and the problem that it poses to the very fabric of our society, with respect, of course, to our marriages and to our families. One police officer in Toronto, Canada, says, "We are never going to arrest our way out of this." In some areas, only 0.1% of offenders, that is, offenders meaning those who traffic in child porn, are caught. Now, that's child porn, which is illegal. Then there is legal porn. All we hear about is the child porn whenever they try to bust some of these rings or traffickers. That's what you're hearing about, not what is called legal or adult porn. That's a different matter. By the way, Brisbane is, I've heard some time ago, I don't know how current this is, the porn capital just about of the world in terms of those who that they can trace that are just into this. You wouldn't know simply because people view this, these kind of things, on their computers, and they do so at work. Only 60% in the United States of companies, by the way, have what do you call filters, locks, or something, blocks, that is, on the computers to where people who are at work can't get to it. However, they do find out that most of it, when they've done traces on it, most of porn is viewed between 9 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon. If you're an employer, just thought I'd let you know. So that some of these, that's what you're paying for some people's work time while they're doing these sort of things. However, once again, it's very difficult to deal with people who are into this. Dr. Judith Reisman, an internationally recognized author, scientist, and educator specializing in sexual perversion, says the growing appetite for child pornography corresponds to the pornographic erotoxic epidemic. In other words, as I said, we only look at the child pornography side of it, but there is an epidemic that there's a different the same principle is involved here, and they call that it's called in science a social contagion or emotional contagion, as this Dr. Reisman explains. Historically, it is known as monkey see, monkey do. Pornography wires viewers' brains to lust after rape of women and children. Globally breeding nations of child rapists, serial rapist murderers, and the like among men, women, and even children. Well, Reisman said pornography mutilates the human brain and creates offenders rather than simply pandering to an existing pathology. In other words, you might say, well, a person has a certain tendency and you satisfy that through pornography. It doesn't. It creates something far worse than that, and it spreads. That's the point she's making here. Erotoxins turn what could have been normal, decent humans into vile and deformed molesters, she said. Our brains and our behavior are shaped by our environment. And I will tell you, that's not something that the human mind or brain, as they say brain, you and I, we use the term mind, should never be exposed to this kind of thing. It really shouldn't, for, I think, obvious reasons. Some people will withstand pornographic conditioning due to their genetic inheritance, perhaps, but they would withstand it more likely due to strong moral absolutes. However, even those moral absolutes can be exploited and violated by exposure to these erotoxins we call pornography. Reisman said that someone who sees no connection between legal porn and child porn pandemic is in denial. In other words, that's people think, well, what adults do, that's okay, that's up to them, but they don't understand this is where it moves to. And that is what they've made illegal. They never thought to make the whole thing illegal. I mean, God certainly has. But so far as our civil society is concerned, they did not make that illegal. Literature, music, art, cross-cultural history, and current brain science all coalesce to confirm the addictive, destructive process of all sexually provocative visual stimuli, said Dr. Reisman. All porn are erotoxic because the brain converts sexual images into an endogenous drug high via the reward system. Pouring a supranormal drug cocktail similar to cocaine throughout the brain and the body. All right, what all that is essentially saying is this, that whenever you see something that has such a very powerful and emotional impact on you, your body will create chemicals, all right, that gives a person a high in a way that they have not experienced it before. The withdrawal state following use will be the same as withdrawal from a street drug, calling the user back to the source of image arousal. Like alcoholics, any cue that is associated with their lust, in the case of alcoholics, it's booze or alcohol, will drive the addict or the user back to his or her source. Then, of course, we're familiar with addictions where actual drugs are used, illegal drugs, and even many times prescription drugs. But in some cases, you have habits like this that are where no external drugs are used, but it is still a drug-like type of a thing. But why do people get into drugs? What happens within the person? We say it's a habit. Well, why is it a habit? We tend to think it's a physical addiction. But why is it such a destructive habit? We tend to think that this is a chemical substance that a person comes to rely on. But porn has no chemical substance, as we're saying. There are chemical changes in the brain, but there is no external chemical substances introduced with pornography. Alcohol, it's a very serious problem among teenagers. We see so much violence among the youth, and it is generally at pubs and parties or other groupings where there is drinking. People's behavior is changed, and they do things that they would never otherwise do. Gambling, no chemical substance here, but we realize the nature of this sin. It is addictive to some people. Homosexuality. People don't talk about that in these terms. Now, because, you know, you've got to be politically correct. Well, we're not politically correct here, but this is where people get off by simply calling it a sexual orientation. Now, it is true that some do have some abnormal physical problems. There's abnormal productions of male hormones or lack thereof. This then becomes a medical problem. There are some people with these medical problems. But a person can develop a sexual orientation that has little to do with or nothing to do with a person's physical production of hormones. In other words, it's not the way they were born, as the gay community would have you to believe. They say, well, people are born that way, therefore it's natural and it's normal and so on. Well, it's not. God says it's not. And they try to link it back up to, well, that's just the way the person is, and they don't put it down to anything more than that. Something was short-circuited in the person's wiring. Something happened to the individual that led him or her to choose a certain particular orientation when there is no reason for them to do so medically or physically. And that is not present. Yet they still choose a certain a sexual orientation. Now, I just simply gave you a number of things. There's a lot of other things we may mention, and I'll cover them as we get to it. But there's something here that will start to emerge when we understand the nature of these kinds of sin. In fact, I hope that you will see before the sermon is over the nature of all kinds of every sin, for that matter, that it is addictive in nature. Now, let me just give you a scenario. Consider how an addiction to pornography might develop. A young Christian man with no history of sexual misbehavior spends an overnight visit with friends who have cable TV in the guest room. As he prepares for bed, he flips on the television, hoping to catch a late-night sports wrap-up. The TV is set on a late-night movie channel. The first picture to greet his eyes is a sexually explicit scene from an R-rated movie. Something stirs inside as his eyes fasten on the screen. More than the obvious sexual stirrings are involved, he feels something far deeper than sexual excitement. He feels alive and vital. Now, some people in the same situation would immediately switch channels, believing it is wrong to expose themselves to such stimulation. Others would watch it, enjoy it without the same sense of coming alive, turn it off when it was over, and perhaps think little of it about what they saw. However, let's take this young man in question. Assume the young man is a typical good Christian. He is sincerely committed to living by God's ways, but for some reason, this first episode with a pornographic scene has a certain effect on him. There is something that was missing in his life, perhaps that he could not define or explain when this event came along. It had an effect on him unlike anything else he had experienced. So we have to somehow explain, and counselors have endeavored to do this, as to why would it have an effect on some and not on others. In one case, the profound disappointment of an uninvolved father had been written off in the young man's mind as just one of those things. Dad was gone a lot, but I think I got used to it, he says. It didn't bother me much. Dad loved me in his own way. Neither has the demeaning overprotection of a hovering mother been permitted to destroy him. Mom? Oh, she's okay. Yeah, she hugs me some. I think she still wishes I was her little boy. She means well. We get along fine. Now, there is a denial in his voice as he would try to explain himself, but he dismisses it as no big deal. Life is really quite pleasant. His casual desires are nicely met through a good job and excellent health. He has plenty of friends, a few he considers close friends, enough to live life without having to face whatever it is he's dealing with in his own life. Whatever longings he has for a deeper or a satisfying relationship with God, as his pastor keeps talking about, has not yet been acted upon. He knows that that is the direction he has to go, but for now, there's plenty of things to do. And with the optimism that is reserved for younger folks, he assumes that he will one day meet the right woman and will become, a well-established, happy, and prosperous family man. Any longing for God to be truly committed to God presents no conscious problem. He is respected in the church. He rarely does he sense the need for a deeper relationship with Christ. That's for older believers, the ministry maybe, elders and deacons also. A few problems he has or somehow handled, maybe by more prayer, more devotions, more distractions in other ways, living within the community of the church helps, and even exercise helps keep bad habits under control. Now, very few would pick this person as a candidate for developing a serious compulsion for pornography. Why did a 5-second scene of explicit sexual behavior produce a sense of satisfaction so right that it seemed necessary for life? Why was his mind flooded for hours and weeks with images of what he had seen on TV? Why, during his next trip to the Quick Stop food store, did he linger by the magazine rack? Why did he soon create a reason to pay a second visit to his friend who had the cable TV? And why did he sign up for cable himself 3 months later, persuading himself that he only wanted a better reception and access to the 24-hour sports channel? So 4 years after this, he comes into the counselor with an obsessive preoccupation with pornography. He has sneaked into adult bookstores, stayed up late at night to watch sexually explicit movies, and couldn't look at an attractive woman without mentally undressing her. Why? What happened? Now, the problem is easily explained. I think you and I can understand how a problem like this could develop. It's not easily solved. That's a different matter. But I think we can explain it, and that's part of what we're going to deal with today. Most habits seem powerless to control, grow out of our attempt to relieve some issue, some pain even, sometimes unbearable pain that results from a failure to deal with the disappointments in life. There are certain voids that were never legitimately satisfied through healthy relationships that should have occurred, that the person should have experienced, and the person may not be able to explain all of this themselves. But somehow, in some way, when they become exposed to something like this, it somehow lodges with the individual, whereas with others, it doesn't. But this particular person, it did. This young man became hooked on pornography because the thrill of sexual pleasure he derived from pornography more closely approximated the genuine joys of deep relationship than any experience he had known. It was not simply a matter of a physical pleasure. It gave an emotional rush. There was something else that was happening that was simply more powerful than simply physical pleasure, is what a lot of people put this down to. Now, if you don't experience God's love, if you don't experience God, simply as that, in a very deep way that you can and you should, the appeal of a broad range of intense pleasures may become compulsively attractive. The power of bad habits is not simply the pleasure they provide. Sinful habits become compulsively attractive when the pleasure they give relieves a deep disappointment in the soul better than anything else you can imagine, and better than anything that they have experienced before. And somehow it does something for the person. You do have to ask the question, why do young people get into alcohol? What happens whenever they begin to drink? What is the effect? What is the effect of getting into drugs and the use of drugs? What is going on there? It's not just the physical effect, it's also what it does to the person in terms of dealing with certain emotional issues, one might say even spiritual issues, in the person's life that have never been resolved, that should have been dealt with or healthily dealt with within the context of, let's say, a normal family, an ordinary family, a family where the roles were properly structured and so ordered to where the basic needs of individuals were met, and they were very, very secure in that matter. They would be far less susceptible to something like this than that would come along. Now, none of us live in a perfect world. We're all affected by forces beyond our control. With some of us, our lives had been out of control. Something was missing and we didn't know what it was, but we found a way to meet the need with the satisfaction that for a time, a short time, fulfills like nothing else ever has. So, whatever generates pleasure seems so right. Pleasures of the body, such as sex, or eating, or pleasures of the mind, such as power, applause, for instance, can be marvelous counterfeits of real life when you haven't experienced God, when you haven't gone that far, when you don't know what that is, and where you need to have that ultimate fulfillment through that relationship with God, and really sincerely, wholeheartedly move in that direction, then something can come along that will and can be a counterfeit. Their insidious appeal lies in their power to give quick relief from sometimes the pain, the groaning that we have within ourselves, a relief that feels more than good. It feels like life. And it does something to you, to the person. When any behavior or substance or sin is used to satisfy or at least quiet our cries for what we really need and only what God can Himself provide, then it becomes a demanding tyrant, driving us toward whatever relief is available. And it is. We become subject to it. We become in bondage to it. We become hooked on it, as it were. And it becomes then a way of life that we get into. Now, you might say, I understand that with drugs. I understand that with porn now. I understand that with alcohol. I understand that with gambling. I understand that. One can even understand that with anorexia, can't they? Absolutely. I think you can understand that. Because even that is doing something for the person which is so powerful in their minds that they will die in order to satisfy what it is that they have so very powerful in their minds. And what is that? You've seen it on television. I've seen it on television. I've heard anorexics even talk about it, where they confess they know that they have something that they have got to live up to, and it's so powerful, and that is to become a very slim person. You know, and that's it. That's in their minds. And for whatever reason, something really got distorted here. And they will do any. They see themselves in a certain way, and they will do anything, even die, to satisfy that need within them. You and I understand something went terribly wrong for the person to become so obsessed to that extent. And once we get into it, it is a tyrant. As we said, it's a good word for it that's been used, where it makes these demands on us and we are subject to it, we are in bondage to it, and we can't find our way out of it. Let me give you one more example here. A vulnerable young man, he's vulnerable for could be any number of reasons, but basically has to do with certain feelings that he has, certain insecurities that he may have. For whatever reasons, has an early experience with a homosexual. Now, it gave to this person then, in a perverted way, a satisfaction, an experience that dwarfed any other issue he has had in his life. And from that moment, he is hooked. And from that time on, he tries to repeat the emotional high he experienced the first time. Here's a key word in it. The first time. That's it. There's something that a person experiences the first time that they always try to go back and recapture. Now, they never really do, but they get into it more and more in order to recapture it. Now, Johnny Cash, if you all know who he is, tells his story when he was on tour, traveling, playing night after night. He, on the road, he was so wiped out, he did not know how he could even go on for that night. And as he was about to go on, his guitar player pulls a little white pill out of his pocket, and he said, "Here, take this." Johnny takes it, and he didn't sleep for 2 days, almost 3 days. And he went from one gig to the other, and he was on such a high, and it was such a fantastic experience as to what it did for him, unlike anything. And all of any problems, any issues that he had before that he was struggling with, whatever it was, made no difference because this pill then took care of the problem. And so he said, "We've got to get some more of those pills." And thus began the long road of trying to recapture the first time. That's the key. And he never could do it. See, that's the nature of this thing. You cannot ever go back and recapture the first time if it's wrong, because it has done something for the person in a way that God never intended for it to do. He destroyed his relationships, his family, eventually his career hit rock bottom until he could get off this little magic pill that at the beginning did so much for him and at the beginning offered so much. The first time he took it. What makes a gambling habit? Follow the logic through, folks. I think you already know. What makes a gambling habit? The first big win. That'll get you into it. Best thing for a person to do is to lose. Lose big time. What makes a sex addict? Or what makes a habitually sexually immoral person, a man or a woman? It seems like it becomes part of the answer that the person has been searching for, because it does something for the person in a way that they have not experienced before, which they should have, in a normal, in a healthy way, because God did intend for us to live a healthy and a wholesome life. But things go wrong. As I said, we don't live in a perfect world. And we tend to very easily go to the wrong places to solve the issues that are in our lives. And we go down a road then which involves sin in some form or another. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. Do not love the world or the things in the world. And if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. John makes no bones about it. He says, look, it's one or the other. That's simply the way it is. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. That's interesting the way he puts it. The world is passing away, and the lust of it. Why does lust become lust? How did you do that? How did you get into it? How did you get into such a thing where it has such an appeal to you that a thing becomes lust? Now, the devil has tried to tell you, a lot of bad things about some of the things God created. It's not lust. However, some things do become lust in ways which are not healthy. But he who does the will of God abides forever. It's very interesting why he says that. He who does the will of God abides forever. That is, a person has made the right choices. A person is not going to be controlled by the world or what the world offers or the solutions the world offers, but is going to be making the right decision. That's why he's going to abide forever. That's the person who will live forever, not the person who's going to take shortcuts to deal with whatever it is he's dealing with in his life by going down the road of sin in order to get a certain amount of an emotional high or a pleasure or whatever it is that for the moment seems to cover up whatever else it is the person is dealing with. Genesis 3, Jeff already quoted this, but let's take a look at another part of this. Genesis 3, now I submit to you something took place here in a way which is similar to what we've been describing. It's not just some sort of mystical thing that kind of a person, something happened to the person and they didn't know what happened. Well, something did happen. It's very important to know what really happened here. Verse 2, the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden." There were plenty of things in which God had a way where the person may live and have such absolute fulfillment with everything that God provided was in the garden. But the fruit of the tree, which is in the midst of the garden, God said, "You shall not eat of it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Now, something was presented to her in such a way where it had never been described to her like this before. This was more than anything else she had ever imagined or knew or had told to her up until this time. Now the devil is doing this. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, she bought into it, and that it was pleasant to the eyes. There we are. And a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Now there's a little bit of an issue there as to what they are actually experiencing. Why was this so appealing? Why did it have such an effect on them? And it did. I'm submitting to you that there was something very powerful going on here, similar to what we have been describing in the case of certain addicts. That there's something that's taking place here when she listened to what the serpent said. Why did God know that once they did this, they would be hooked? Now, he knew that. It wasn't just going to be a one-off thing. You see, it's the first time. Once you do it the first time, you're into it. And that's what people don't understand. They say, well, one time doesn't hurt. Yes, one time does. Because once you're into it, you're into it. And it does do something for you. In a way, if you're vulnerable, you'll try to somehow go back and recapture it because things are not right in your own life. And this becomes a solution. It becomes a way to where you can somehow deal with whatever it is, whatever other issues are in your own life. It becomes something you can now deal with. Now, it is true. They had the perfect parent, God. And yet the devil made this so absolutely appealing to them, so it provided something that God was not about to provide. We're not talking here about substance addiction. We're talking about choosing a way that gives a rush like nothing else they had experienced up until that time. What do you think they got out of choosing the way of freedom, so they thought, that made this so compelling? Now, either you're going to be satisfied with a relationship with God, relationship that He's offering forever, or you're going to settle for the shortcuts offered by this world and what this world says it will do for you. It will do something for you. Yes, it will. Everything the world offers will do something for you. Make no mistake. You will find a satisfaction. You will find a buzz. You will find a rush in it, unlike anything you have ever experienced, but only for a short time. Like the fireworks on New Year's Eve. A quick, bright light, and then darkness. More darkness than you've ever seen before comes after. And it is the quick, immediate, bright counterfeit that you will try to recreate. And you will never reach that first time again. You never will. You are now into sin, with no way out unless someone shows you the way. Or you experience more pain from the solution than the pleasure that you derive from the sin. In other words, there is going to come pain from this. More pain than you ever thought you could ever experience. That sometimes turns a person around. Cain was angry. He murdered his brother. It didn't just happen. Because of what his mother and father did, they were cut off from God's purpose and God's spirit. And what was left for Cain was to try to somehow satisfy what he had lost. And to him, it became a distortion. And what he lost and what he was grieving for was the ascendancy, being the oldest son. And the person standing in his way was Abel. He was an angry and embittered man. We know that. God called him on it. So why are you angry? Why are you angry at your brother? His anger and jealousy became a way of life. It became a way of coping, a way of living alongside Abel, his brother. He learned to criticize. He learned to despise. It gave him a buzz in a way that nothing else did. It worked for him. It worked for Cain. It helped him to deal with the situation. And so he walked around with a bad attitude, as we say. That's what Dr. Phil says, doesn't he? People do what works for them. Cain was doing what worked for him. And so his anger, his hatred, his embitterness worked for him. It helped him to cope. It helped him to live. It gave him something that he couldn't get any other way. And he certainly wasn't going to turn back to God and forsake that. Oh, he was on a high. Do you ever notice how whenever you're angry at somebody, when you're in a rage with somebody, you are in an emotional high? Do you ever notice that? And you know that people do that, they repeat it. They do this again and again and again. And it gets worse and worse. And they try to go back and repeat. They never recapture, let's put it that way, that original feeling that they have. But it just keeps going because it's doing something for them. They do what works. It works for them. And so the feeling, the attitude, the hard feelings, the grudges, the unforgiveness, all of this that goes with it, the inability to cope with life's problems, being a victim, everything. This becomes an emotional rush. You've got to understand what it does for people. And when you do it in groups, it's worse. And you can see this. You can see, I don't know if you've seen it in some movies where, what is it? You have the Indian tribes that do the war dance. They really get all worked up into a fury, into a hatred, into a rage. And they'll go out and they all die in front of the guns of the cavalry. How stupid could you be? That's what it does. Oh, they were on a high. They were on a rush. Sin does this. So they're trying to deal with their issues in a wrong way. They're going to in all the wrong places. Cain was no different. It gave him the answers to the dilemma of what he felt deprived of. Eventually it came to fruition. He kills his brother, and he sees too late that it did nothing for him. And he said, "My punishment is too much for me to bear. Why did I do such a stupid thing?" But up until Cain killed Abel, his emotions were his staples. It's what he lived by. His food. His penalty was greater than the satisfaction it gave him to do the deed. Once it was done, now you saw that it didn't do what he thought it did or could do for him. It's an amazing thing. Sin's a terrible thing. Look what Judas did. He was so right in everything he did. So right in his view of Christ. He was the only one who saw it, and he was so correct, and he was so built up with anger and hatred and bitterness toward Jesus after a while, where he felt he could just betray him. And then once he did, then he saw it wasn't the right thing to do. He saw it didn't do anything for him. But up until then, he was on a high. He was on an emotional high. So high, it seemed like the answer to everything. So he goes straight to the high priest. No reservations, no compunctions, no guilt, no holding back. He goes into it with both feet, and he betrays Christ. You see, people don't understand what sin does. How the kind of hold it gets on you, and it starts out not full-blown like this, but we find a way of somehow we're hooked. We're hooked on the feeling. We're hooked on the pleasure. We're simply hooked. Of course, God has a lot to say about feelings, doesn't it? Every sin, every lust, every desire, when it comes to its fullness, leaves you with a horror that you have all the while searched for the answer and you came to a dead end. Now, eventually, that's going to happen to all of mankind. I think that's the dynamic of it. We can understand that man's going to find... Now let me explain it one more time, and then we're going to start talking about some things here in a minute. I think we can see an example of this in the current solutions to this terrible financial mess we're all in now. Our country, the world, our families are all suffering from the result of living a way that says you can get something for nothing. Alan Greenspan called it a rational exuberance at one point, a couple of bubbles ago. Remember, he used that term. It's irrational exuberance, a rush when you are prospering in a way that you never experienced before, especially when you didn't earn it, when you didn't work for it. It was just simply happening to you, and you were going along with it. A huge housing bubble was the result of people trying to get something they didn't earn by their own labor or their own productive effort. Everything was all of a sudden worth more, and not realizing that nobody earned or produced that wealth. It was just there. And we found out that we couldn't pay for what we bought. Things began to collapse. Now, that's the natural result of sin. I saw this sign greed will destroy us, written on, where was that? Oh, that was written on that guy in Townsville who encouraged all these people to invest the money, wasn't it? Storm Financial? Storm. Good name. Greed will destroy us. That's it. You don't understand. It's a natural result of sin. So then you have the so-called solution, the bailout plans that are coming along. Create more money or debt to pay for debt that you had before. Does anybody see anything wrong with this? This will solve the problem. Will it solve the problem? It will seem like it will solve the problem. Now, all of you are thinking people, and I think you can see by just creating money to take the pressure off the banking institutions holding the bad debts is going to create a bigger problem for us later because we have to pay for it. It's just like the drug addict. He's got to do more. This is why the habit gets worse. This is what we're doing, by the way. Now, the reason I just sort of threw that example in to show you in a macro sense how the same dynamic works out within a society the world as a whole, in fact. The nature of sin is it will make you pay. When you thought that you were getting something for nothing, when you thought you were bypassing the hard yakka, when you thought you were bypassing the character of God and the relationship with God and what God had for you, when you thought you were doing it all the easy way and you were going to go down that road, you thought you were getting something for nothing. And it's all going to come back on us. All of sin is trying to get something in an illegitimate way that will backfire on you. That is, you will pay for it dearly. Now, God's laws aren't to deprive us or to make things hard for us. It's simply the best way. It's the best way to live that's best for all. You benefit, and everyone is benefited because that is the best way. And here's why sin is so wrong. Because you're getting something at the expense of someone else. Yes, you are. You're getting something at the expense of someone else. And that's why sin is wrong. God's way is totally the opposite. So, He sent His Son. God sent His Son. We've got to come out of the bondage of sin, and we have to understand that we are free. We're freed from this. We don't have to go back into it. And it's interesting what He's got to say about it. We'll explore some of this as we lead up to the Passover. But it's a terrible dilemma the world was in. It's a terrible dilemma that we were all in before we understood this. And if we're still in it, it's a terrible dilemma. Let's turn to Romans chapter 6, verse 11. Romans 6, verse 11. People completely misunderstand what Paul is saying. But in the context of what we're talking about, I think it becomes somewhat clearer. Romans 6, verse 11, we could read the whole chapter, but we don't have time for that today. But likewise, you also reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord. The first time the young man sees a pornographic film or scene, he is alive. He comes alive. It's doing something for him in such a very powerful way. These are very powerful, powerful images. That's why you don't ever get started on them, folks. You just don't. Now, he says, You're dead to sin. That is, you're dead to the effects it has on you. But you are alive to God. Now there is something that he's saying here, that the only, if you want to really be alive, it's with God. That's the only true way. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. Why does it reign in your mortal body? Because it's doing something for you. You're doing what works. It is dealing with something, some issue. It is dealing with some void, some pain in your life. It is dealing with it. And you have found that sin somehow gives you momentary relief. And so people go down the road of sin. And they try to recreate it. They try to do it again and again and again. And they're hooked. Because it does give momentary relief. Any sin will give momentary relief of some kind. That's why it reigns. And the person says, that's the way I want to go because I see what it's doing for me. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. That's the payoff. There's a payoff. That you should obey it in its lust. That's how he puts it. Do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead. If you really want to be alive, he says, if you go down that road, you're really dead. You're dead. And your members as instruments of righteousness to God. Verse 14, for sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under the law, but under grace. All sin exercises dominion. All sin exercises dominion or control over the person. What then? Shall we sin because we are not under the law but under grace? Certainly not. You do not know to whom that you present yourselves slaves to obey. You are that one slaves to whom you obey, whether it is whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. And I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, it does, you know. Lawlessness leads to more lawlessness. And so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. And what fruit? What was the fruit did you have then in the things which you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. The whole world is going to come to a dead end one day, and they realize that's it. We're dead. And then somebody is going to have to rescue them. But now having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. And the end, everlasting life. So in our desperation to find answers, sin comes along and gives us a way to somehow deal with what we sense within ourselves is a need. It fills the void. It's satisfying. It's fulfilling. That's the nature, not of some sin, it's the nature of all sins. It's the shortcut to dealing with the problem, with the dissatisfaction, the frustrations, and the problems of life, the lousy way we feel about those problems. The See, it's important to understand the nature of sin, why it's so easy, why it's so appealing, and why most times it seems for the short term an answer to our problems, and why we can develop a particular habit that is sin, and it turns out to be with us for a lifetime. We need to recognize it for what it is, the habit of sin. And we tend to say, well, it isn't that important. We minimize it. The effect wasn't all that great. And sometimes we say that with drugs we take. Sometimes we say that with sneaking a little bit of pornography or whatever it is. I don't know. I'm telling you something. It is doing something to you. And it's not a physical thing. Only a physical thing. It is an emotional thing. And here then is the dynamic. Here's the dynamic. I don't care what sin you want to get into. You can become a thief. Worst thing in the world for a thief to do is to have success the first time. The worst thing for to happen to a person who will lie is for him not to get caught, because it works. It gets a person something in some cases. It gets a cheap position in the mind of somebody else. It does something for you. And that does something for the person. You ever see a parent? They just lie all the time. It's habitual. It gives them, it does something for them, because they have somehow reached a certain position in the minds of somebody else. It's powerful. Somehow the legitimate processes of self-worth were thwarted in a person's life. And now to know that someone thinks highly of you, even though it was because of a lie, can give you a false sense of significance. And it is addictive. Gossip and slander. It's one of the worst. Because we think we're getting away with it, and it really does something for the person who does it. You may be a little bit ahead of me on this one. Because it does. It gives a person a buzz. It's doing something for you. We get into this thing, and God condemns it. He really does. He hates the one who sows discord among brethren. The simple reason of the person is doing this at the expense of somebody else. And it's cheap. It really is. The dynamic for all of these sins are the same. You're taking a shortcut to resolve whatever it is you're dealing with in your life, or you're dealing with a consequence of previous sins, and it seems to be the solution. It's important to understand the nature of sin and why the world is going the way it is, and the only solution for us. There is such a resistance to God's laws, and you ought to ask why that is so. Why is there such a resistance to God's laws? It's because we know we can't have something the easy way. That's what's happening. And it stops you. Stops you cold from taking that easy road to try to get something in a way that is not legitimately yours. Now, 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1 sets it forth. Sets the whole picture here for us. Second Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves. Now it starts out with that. What we're finding now is that all of the moral absolutes are being broken down, and people more and more and more are going to go toward the way of shortcuts. That's why we're in the financial mess we're in today. It's because it seemed like it was the thing to do. It was, looking back on it, it was so irrational. It was so emotional. It was such a high. It had to be right. That's the last days we're in. Why is it then you have so many things going on today, and media just plays right into it and delivers it right into your home, of the pleasures of the mind, pleasures of the eyes, pleasures of the flesh, and it's all there. And a person gets into that, and pretty soon, whatever it is that you had a problem with way back in your life is gone. You can get sports 24 hours a day, and then you don't have to worry about your problems anymore until they throw you out of your house. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, and here's the operative word right here. Here's the word. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. There's your choice. The world is going to continue to make the wrong choice. It's going to continue heading down the road to where they see, this is where it's gotten them. There is a love of God that you and I should come to, and that's reflected, of course, deeply within the Passover, which we will come to between now and the Passover to understand why, then, one makes that kind of a choice. And you do when you understand certain things. And that's why it's important to understand who Christ is. It's important to understand what he did. It's important to understand the fact that he really did die. And that sacrifice and that love was there in such a way as the only thing that can somehow deal with the terrible things sometimes we deal with in our lives. And to know that there are answers that are deeply satisfying and can only reach deep into the soul. And that is through Jesus Christ. Now, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 and verse 29, I believe sets it out very well. Hebrews 11, 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now think about that. What could he have had if he'd have simply allowed things to go on as he was? Choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Now this is most remarkable. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Now everybody has a choice. There is something that we see, or we should see, within the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, in Christ himself, that makes us say, I'll choose him in the suffering rather than the pleasure that I'm going to get over here. What would do that? What is that? What is so powerful as that? To make the person then say, I will suffer now. I will choose the reproaches of people now. I will take that road now and give up pleasures that are at my feet, at my beck and call, that I've got them. I don't have to do one thing. Just stay where I'm at. What makes a person make that kind of a choice? What do they see? What do they know? You have to know something. You really do. And it's embodied within, let's say, our understanding of the Passover. Who he is. What did he do? Why did he do it? Who he was. And what was demonstrated in a way that nothing else was like it. And so you make that choice. Now that's what he's saying to do here. That's what Moses did. That's why Moses was a remarkable person. He made that choice. And then God took it from there. But he had to make that choice. And he says, if this is what it meant, this is what it meant, I suffer. If it means I die, I die. I'm making this choice. I don't care what kind of pleasures of the flesh, pleasures of the mind, pleasures of this life I could have for abundance. No affliction, no pain, no nothing. Everything is mine. And it was. What makes a person make the right decision? Well, there we are. Gives us something to think about, doesn't it? Between now and the time of the Passover. We take that Passover, that's what we say we're doing. We take the Passover, we're saying that's the decision we're making. We'll take the reproaches of Christ. We'll suffer with Christ. Doesn't matter what the world's going to offer me or what it'll do for me. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Thanks for coming today.